Do you know if this our server or the Tapper server has PHP available?
I believe it does, yes.
I emailed John but never got a reply.
Yeah, I haven't got a reply back from John on a couple SFTP questions too, so he must be busy. But I'm pretty sure we have PHP, and I don't know. I kind of vaguely remember at the board meeting talking about what services we have in our ISP.
Yeah, well, one of the things is if we're going to do this where we have a directory where we store things, and actually if we do the same for Mike's recordings, I can make a something that looks more like a web page but is essentially that directory listing that we have right now.
Okay, can you do that for the documents directory also?
Yes, I can do it for both. And basically, all I needed to was to know if we had PHP.
Oh, okay. And the thing I wanted to ask you then maybe is I want to point an A record to that directory so people can just look at teamspeakarchives.tangerinestr.com and they'll go right to the directory where you put everything.
Yep. Well, I already did where if you click on documents, it goes to the directory. And I can do the same thing for Mike's directory. The one thing I thought about was if you have a lot of people that need to modify documents, we could just set up a GitHub and put the documents there and then periodically copy them across.
Yeah, and I was talking to my business partner at lunch today, and he says, "Well, why are you guys reinventing the wheel? Just choose GitHub."
Well, GitHub will do most of this stuff. The only problem is some people are not used to GitHub, but I think most of the folks that we have here should be.
Yeah, so that may be a good solution. Although I do like having master copies on the site, although then you end up with two sources, which is sometimes confusing or hard to keep synced.
Well, I can make something that will once a day or once every whatever time interval you want, but it usually once a day
User
bring
joined your channel.
things across from the other site and essentially put them on the website version.
Oh, like essentially like a cron job or you do a PHP clock query or something.
Yeah, just that's what I was thinking is a cron job.
Oh, look, I think Bill's going to be here and Tom's here. So you want to do the honors, the first official one?
Sure. Well, welcome to the first session of TeamSpeak for the Tangerine SDR project. My name is Dave, KV0S, and I've been setting up the websites and working on getting the recordings from Dayton up. I'm about over halfway now. I put some new ones up today. Hopefully, I get the rest of them done before too long. Next on the list, we have Dave. KD0EAG. Dave, go ahead.
Hi, everybody. I hope my levels are somewhat reasonable. Just thought I'd poke my nose in and see what's going on.
Very good, Dave. And then we have next on the list, Mike, AA8K, is recording in a way, and Mike usually records sessions. He has recorded the sessions on the Open HPSDR site for several years. And so I'm used to working with Mike. Next, we have Tom in 5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, hello, Dave and everyone. This week, I've been running some experiments with the MIT Haystack recording format. I think they call it digital RF, and doing some performance measurements of throughput onto hard drive. And I've also been looking at NTP time for formatting the timestamps in the packets that the FPGA puts out.
Yep. Well, fine business, Tom. Interested in hearing more about that. Next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, hello, Dave, and thanks for running this, the first inaugural session, I guess we call it. Bill is still having trouble getting audio, so hopefully he'll be able to listen to the recording to get the first part once he gets it figured out. But he has Flex radio drivers installed on his machine. He says it kind of messes up the audio drivers for everyone else, so hopefully he'll get that straightened out, because I got some things I want to talk to him about. Notably, I got the preliminary specification not specification, requirements document done. And I put it up on the in the documents folder on tangerinesdr.com, and hopefully trying to just nail down some of the configurations that I have in my mind of how the protocol has got to handle, what the protocol has to handle. Really looking forward to comments from Tom and Bill, and maybe John Ackerman and whoever else is a networking expert. Well, Dave, you're pretty expert on networking too, so maybe you can see if it makes sense. But that's kind of what I've been working on this past week. So back over to you, Dave.
Well, fine business, Scotty, and I look forward to hearing that. And then we have Bill, AB4EJ, and I don't know, Bill seems to be still working with his drivers. Bill, are you there? Well, okay. We'll let Bill work on his drivers, and that brings us to the end of the list, so we're open for general discussion.
So, Dave or Tom, have you had a chance to look at that document? I know I only posted it earlier today, so it's pretty short notice, and I know, Dave, you've been pretty busy with videos. You're almost done. That's awesome.
Yeah, the editing software messes up my audio for this, so I have to reboot the machine between from when I'm editing videos and when we run TeamSpeak.
Sounds like the same thing that Flex does. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't notice that you'd posted a document. I haven't looked at it yet.
Yeah, it was very stealthy because I answered a post from Bill and I put the document URL in that post, so it was a stealth mode post.
Okay. Yeah, we're starting to get a pile of specs now. I guess we will need to start moving them over to tangerinesdr.com as time permits.
Yeah, and you know, Dave, we could do that. I mean, I could just pull the ones that people have posted, the latest version that people have posted so far, and put them up in that directory. But Dave was suggesting maybe we should use a GitHub account. And Tapper has a GitHub account, so you know, we can add people. We can create a project and add people to that, I think, pretty easily.
Okay. The concern that I would have about that is that if somebody wants to make a modification to a document and push it up, they're going to have to go through a commit and do a pull request and go through all of that to get a revision of the document.
And then all of our documents will have to be checked in and they'll be under revision control.
Yeah. So you'll require folks to set up a GitHub account, fork the repository, modify the document, and then do a pull request. That may be a bit much for just reviewing documents.
Yeah, and I think maybe we're going to have so few of them. Maybe Dave's idea of what I really wanted was a FTP server that John could set up to put documents into a directory, and then Dave could run a daily move over to the public area. And it looks like Bill is with us now. Can you hear us there, Bill? It's the right-hand Alt key on your keyboard that is PTT, default PTT. Well, I guess one great milestone at a time, right? You can hear but can't talk. Okay, well, anyway, so I think maybe, Tom, you have a good point because we don't want to have people spend a lot of time messing around with GitHub. I mean, if we had software, it would be a different story, but I think for documents, it's not that necessary as long as the author keeps track of the revisions.
Yeah, and I figured for the time being, there's only three or four people producing specs, perhaps. You could just email them to Dave or you or myself, and then we could upload them as we get them by email.
Yeah, I think that'll work. And I'm hearing some stuff from Bill. Are you there yet?
Are you able to copy now?
Yes. Ah, there you are.
Okay, the Alt key is not... I don't know if any of you guys have a Flex radio, but man, it injects about 25 new elements into both your playback and porting things on Windows. You can't run the radio at the same time while doing this. It can't be done. Anyway, I'm here. Sorry.
Oh, no problem. Welcome. Glad you could make it and you got everything working. Are you using PTT still? You're not using Vox, are you?
I don't know how to make it work PTT. I'm just real quiet until it's time to talk.
Oh, you go under the self under record mode, I think, and you can turn off. I hate Vox because it chops off either the first or the last syllable. So I like to use PTT normally. And that's probably why your alt key didn't work, because I think it comes up default in Vox.
Yeah, that's probably true. Well, say again how you set PTT?
Tools, options, and then capture is on for the mic, and then there's some settings for playback.
Okay, I see. Voice activation detect. We turn that off and turn on push to talk. Okay, I'll try that.
Yeah, and your mic is really nice and hot. You get a little bit of you know, the P's and S's are a little mushy, but overall it's pretty good audio on everyone.
Bill, you may need to assign the hotkey for push to talk. I had to on my system.
And that assignment's under tools options also.
Okay, try it now. Any luck now?
Yep, sounds good.
I assigned the right alt key to it. Is it working?
Yes, it is.
Okay, good. That's done.
Okay, cool. So I sent that email to the list explaining about how the program is supposed to work. First of all, Dave, did I cover everything that sounds like the way it's going to work?
I think so. I did read the list, and it made sense. And I do know you want to have – there's both the HamSci personal space radio stuff, but then there's also a few other options that would be more generally ham-related or some other special use related, and I knew you were trying to include those and make sure we don't forget about them.
Yeah, so I'm thinking that we're probably going to end up having to have several web servers depending on the application, and then we'll also want to have local files for the, you know, guys who want to download their files or write their own and store them on their local drive.
I had a question for Tom and Bill regarding private individuals using the space weather. Something I came across just recently in putting these videos up on the web, the uploading rates are using up most of my, at least for the videos, most of my upload allocation, and that seems to be the one that most web service providers limit. Will that be a problem with the individual homeowners being limited on how much data they can push up to the server?
Yeah, actually it might. Did you have a comment, Bill?
I'm thinking it's definitely going to be an issue that we're going to have to deal with because, you know, typically if you're uploading a lot of stuff, the automatic assumption of your internet service provider is that you got a Tor thing and you're uploaded pirated videos and whatnot. What else requires that amount of bandwidth other than the stuff we're going to send?
Yeah, and I've heard of some providers, while they claim that you have unlimited uploads, in reality you don't. So if you start doing excessive data uploads like we might end up providing, the ISPs get upset with you and start either throttling or, I don't know, Bill, whether they, like if they think you're uploading pirated videos, then they're going to cut you off, right?
Well, it's throttling typically. I mean, they're not necessarily the copyright police, but yeah, it can be a real issue. I'm not sure how we're going to deal with that. I mean, it's now, on the other hand, I've been reminded several times that we're designing for the future, and, you know, as fiber to the desktop becomes more prevalent and all of that, maybe it will become less of an issue, but I can see where it could be an issue, like, in the short term.
Well, so it sounds like we have to have a provision to limit it ourselves, then.
Well, it's not a bad idea. There's probably ways that you can throttle it yourself on the upload. And of course, then you got the issue of what impact is that on the ability to do science.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe if we throttle it ourselves, at least we understand that we're being throttled as opposed to blasting it out full speed and then wondering why it doesn't all show up. And you know, maybe it even could be done by the user's modem or router. You know, don't modern routers mostly have QoS and load sharing and ability like there, so you can limit one port from hogging all the bandwidth?
Well, one of the questions I was wondering about was, if you decimate it in a systematic way, it wouldn't be the high quality data, but it might be data that's appropriately sampled across the space.
Well, and if you could upload the appropriately the way down sampled data, and perhaps let the server decide that there's certain areas where it wants more information, and if it can do that within the 24-hour period, it could pick small segments where it could get higher quality data without overloading the user's ISP. So it could come out and say, "Oh, by the way, I looked at your broadband data. Here's the example: is you have a waterfall display. It's only updated 10 frames per second, or maybe less, and it's only 500 pixels wide. So you really don't need to be able to demodulate that audio. You just need very low level, is there a signal there or not, data. But then you could go back in time and say, oh, look, I saw something that I'm interested in. Give me the high resolution data for that time period.
I was reading, some commercial providers of communication services that were talking about doing appropriately chosen run length encoding on highly redundant data streams, too, which I can tell you, certainly the kind of data that you're often looking at here may well be that very susceptible to run length encoding.
Well, could we just compress it using TAR or GZIP or one of those utilities? I mean, can you control? I think you can actually control the amount of compression in a lot of these programs.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. Run length compression is really what I meant.
Yeah, what I'm saying is we may want to take the approach of doing some compression. I guess we're going to have to get some feedback from the science people as to what impact that may have. In fact, we could even run some benchmarks. I mean, we could try having people who have generous bandwidth try it with and without compression and compare the results and see if there enough additional science way down in the tiny details that it justifies jumping through a lot of hoops to get this massive amount of data transferred with uncompressed.
Yeah, it may be. I think the science folks are going to have to take a look at that. The closer the signal is to noise, the more difficult it would be to compress, I would think. And secondly, if we have things like precision timestamps in the data, in order to do correlation, we have to make sure that whatever compression we would do doesn't impact that in any way.
Well, here's the thing. We've been looking at using the digital RF package from MIT, which uses HDF5 behind the scenes, and they have a way of putting the timestamp into metadata. So doesn't matter how you compress the data, the timestamp remains uncorrupted.
Yeah, I'm thinking more along the lines that if you compress and then uncompress data, you may shift the phase of that data.
I guess it's possible. Another thing that maybe we need to test. That would be a good paper to be published just right there.
Yeah, it may depend on the particular science campaign that the researchers are trying to go through. And sometimes they may have one set of requirements, and at a different time they may have different requirements.
Well, here's another thing that we might be able to do. If you're looking at a specific time and a specific frequency, it seems like you might be able to, especially post-processing, you might be able to look at the dynamic range that you actually recorded and really, really, really reduce the dynamic range of the data that you are sending out. And does that make sense, what I just said?
You can get rid of the most significant bits if they're never activated. What you could achieve there maybe is a 2-to-1 or something like that.
Well, I'm thinking of, if you're listening at on 10 meters on a very quiet band and you're listening for some very low-level activity, I mean, suppose that all of the signals are below minus 110 dBm. I mean, you could do a 100-to-1 reduction in dynamic range and you'd still be fine. But, of course, you have to record it all at full dynamic range and then post-process it and say, oh, look, nothing went above minus 110 dBm, so I can do some kind of scale or compression or something on the data, and it would take up many, many, many bits less storage.
Yeah, that's true. One concern would be if there are dozens of signals of interest, even at low level, they start to add up, and you know the dynamic range starts to creep up when you're looking at a wideband signal. But there's probably still some compression that can be done.
Okay. Well, I wanted to ask Bill if you had it. I think you had a chance to look at the document I put up there today.
Yeah, I did send you a couple of comments regarding that. Pretty lightweight comments. I mean, it's a pretty good document, but just a couple little minor comments, which I emailed right before I left the office this afternoon about, which was, 4:50 U.S. Central Daylight Time.
Yeah, so I actually got that email and I answered you already, but it must have come in after you left. I was just curious as to what you thought of the diagrams and all that. Did they make sense? Were they understandable?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, absolutely. I could figure out what you're getting at and the meaning of the different signal paths. I mean, you might have a little trouble if you're colorblind, but I was able to, because I'm not colorblind, I was able to make good sense out of it.
Yeah, I know. I really didn't want to use color coding, but I really couldn't figure out a way to do it without making the diagrams like B size.
Oh, yeah. I know what you mean. Yeah, well, I mean, you can do some things with dotted lines and different styles of dotted lines and everything. I mean, we don't necessarily have to make the specification Section 508 compliant.
Yeah, until we get a designer that we need to who's colorblind that we need to accommodate. But until that time, I guess, yeah. So as long as I just wanted to make sure I wasn't like off base and not explaining it well at all, because I've been staring at this so long, it all looks like, well, that's obvious. Well, it's not obvious. It's only obvious because I've been thinking about it for 6 months.
Yeah, I think we're moving in the right direction. I have started working on the functional specification for the central control system and database, but that's gonna take a week or two to come out with a first draft, I think, probably. And I will be out of the country for June 19th to June 24th. So I will be out of internet range during that time.
So you're going to Friedrichshafen?
No, I'm going to Scotland for a tour thing that our church is doing. It's coming up on the 200th anniversary of the founding of our church. And they got a bunch of people together to go and see where the founders of Presbyterianism worked and preached and taught and studied. And I mean, that's all of that is not really that fascinating to me, but I have been to Scotland before, so now we're going to get a chance to. Anyway, that's what it is.
Well, that sounds really interesting. I know Dan in 4XW and I were talking about doing the Midlands bicycle tour where you ride your bike across from the Lake District, I guess, in the west all the way over to the North Sea. And it's a bicycle trail. Apparently it's about 110 miles, I think, maybe a little less.
Well, bicycling would be the way to go, I think. It's supposed to be very cool there. Temperatures between the mid-40s and mid-60s. And lots of rain. So, but anyway, yeah. So that's going to be something different. I've been to England and Ireland, but this will be the first time to Scotland. But anyway, I won't be able to. I won't have internet access and all of that while I'm there. That's all I wanted to tell you.
Oh, okay. Well, have a good trip. That sounds like a fun time. That's only really a week, though. I mean, the 19th to the 24th. So yeah, it's. I'll probably be frazzled out for my field day on the Monday after that. Anyway, yeah. I did want to ask you. Oh, go ahead.
Well, it's from the 14th to the 24th. So if you count a day of travel in each direction, it's 8 days? Anyway, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to ask you about the Discovery Protocol, because I know you had said that maybe we don't need it. So I just kind of wanted to toss that around a little bit, because I'm trying to kind of keep the concepts that HPSDR used if we need them. But if we don't need them, then by all means, we don't need them.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. There are a lot of use cases that are what we would consider edge cases, something that would be used by a few people or organizations or institutions. I would think that the typical user who's going to have a personal space weather station in their shack probably is not going to need a discovery process. Now, some of the other use cases, I mean, to keep it simple. Let's just say use case one is a home user and use case two is the institutional user. So now let's say we have a few of the tangerines on somebody's network. Now, I suppose if you didn't have a discovery process, it would necessitate that you individually log into each of the tangerines and configure it and turn it on. Because, you know, the way we've been talking about it was you sit on the web server that's on the tangerine, and then you punch in the IP address or host name, and I guess we have to think about if we want to accommodate IPv6 there too, but anyway, and then you tell it what server you wanted to talk to, and maybe it's off to the races. In that case, there hasn't been this necessity for the, whatever you want to call it, the big client box with all the, storage capacity. It hasn't been any necessity for it to discover the tangerine, because the tangerine always talks first. It reaches out and touches other devices, other systems. So, I don't know. I mean, there's probably no one answer to this question.
So in that use case you were just talking about, you would have the tangerine and its local host in to kind of logically group together, and then you'd have the big kahuna local server, which would have the high-speed data storage on it, but all of this would be at the remote site, and in the case of the non-personal space weather station, there may be no central server whatsoever. That may be all of the hardware that you have.
That last use case that you just mentioned, is that what we call use case one, where the personal space weather station at somebody's home shack?
Well, you called case one is personal use and case two is institutional use, but case one has multiple users because it could be a personal space weather station, it could be a general purpose SDR, it could be a satellite ground station, it could be any of those cases, and they might have different, they all have a data engine and a local host. That becomes that's the tangerine, but then they might have external storage that would be like an NAS or another computer that would have high-speed storage that may be faster than what the local host can accommodate. But even so, in the use case one, it could be that it's a standalone, hobbyist SDR as opposed to a personal space weather station, which of course needs to be connected to the central server somehow.
Okay, so you're thinking of the tangerine in the general purpose sense. I've been just focusing mainly on the space weather station concept. I'm not hesitant to support the discovery process if we need it. If there's a use case, or maybe in, as you mentioned, a bunch of use cases that need that. Let's think. How would that work? I mean, because the thing is, we don't want to make the thing vulnerable to probing, hacking, and all of that mess coming in from the internet. This thing is sitting on the internet. Now, it's maybe not on the raw internet. Generally, even a home user is going to have a router or something in the way. But do we need to think about having a firewall inside the local host? I mean, when you say something's going to be discoverable in this day and age, it brings some issues, some risks onto the stage, and maybe we just have to deal with them. I mean, I think you have a more wide-ranging concept of this whole thing than what a lot of people have been thinking of, but it's not a bad idea.
Yeah, I think. Go ahead, Scotty.
Because I was hoping that the use cases in the requirements document would clarify some of this, because I really think that in the RCC, the remote command and control, we do not want to have a discovery protocol, because that should be done a different way. The LCC, the local command and control, the discovery happens only on one network segment, not across the internet, not across network segments, anything like that. Not that we don't have to have security issues and we have to address security issues there too. But I'm just thinking in the case, and let me give you an example of the setup that I want to do. I'm going to have a receiving SDR and a transmitting SDR, and each one is going to be mounted at the feed point of a different antenna, And each one is going to serve multiple clients so that I can have a single client that will talk to the receive SDR, for instance, on 20 meters and get the 20 meter data. And that same client, if you will talk to the transmit SDR, which is another server. So I've got two tangerines now, and I have, say, three clients. And each one of the three clients is going to request a data stream from each one of the two servers. So if you, it gives you an idea. So envision a two tribanders with a transmitter at one tribander, a receiver at the other tribander, and each one of the antennas or the SDRs at the antenna feeds three clients, and they each feed the same three clients. So there's three streams coming off of each radio, one going to each client, and there's two radios. And does this make? Can you see the topology there?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
sounds like your field day station.
Yes, this is what sparked this whole conversation here.
I wonder if some of this can't be addressed at the level of the software on the small embedded computer, the Odroid or whatever you're using. Virtually all of those Linux implementations have Berkeley packet filter or PF or one of the fairly evolved and mature packet filtering software that could have a set of default rules. It would also address another area of concern that's been mentioned, which is bandwidth throttling, because it has that capability also.
Okay, well, so the idea is really that the see if I can get this right, because this is kind of mixing things up, because the original architecture did not have a local host paired up with every DE. So now that we've paired up a local host with every DE, you got to ask yourself, well, who actually does the discovery? Do the local hosts actually, I mean, they're running the show over their local attached DE. So really, I mean, do they really need to know about the other data engines or only about their own data engine?
Yeah, you have to.
I don't think that you would want the, to be specific, let's say we have the data engine connected to an Odroid. That Odroid should be concerned only with its own data engine, because that's inside the tangerine. That's inside the walls of the tangerine. So all of these different functionalities that we're talking about, all the discovery, let's say the discovery is a process we want to have. What's going to be responding to those discovery is not the data engine, but it's going to be that Odroid, the local host. And since it is a full-blown Linux computer, we can put various security protocols into it, like Dave said, I mean, in case we feel like we need to.
So, Scotty, isn't Andres's setup analogous to this? He has a website where these Kiwi SDRs are all being people are turning them on and then logging into that site, and then anybody on the web can ask for a data stream from any particular radio.
Yeah, I guess in operation it's analogous. The difference is that the people log in, and that there's your discovery there. So the website keeps track of all the people who've logged in, right? So that's kind of, it's a manual discovery, right?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, but I guess the question, oh, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, the key here, I think, is what is the purpose of the discovery protocol? Discovery, you know, in HPSDR does a lot of things. It finds an IP address and gets it assigned to the devices on both ends. It makes sure that those IP addresses are bound with the Ethernet MAC addresses, and it finds those. And if there's nobody handing out DHCP addresses, then it uses an APIPA address. I'm wondering if a data engine is directly connected to a host like the Odroid, does it need all of those functions? Do we really need all of that? Are we just using the Ethernet to transmit frames between the data engine and the Odroid, and the Odroid would be responsible for having an IP address and sending those off to the Internet?
Well, Tom, I think the question at hand is, I think we've already decided that the data engine doesn't need to be able to respond to discovery. The question is, does the Odroid need to be able to respond to discovery?
Well, I don't want to throw a wrench into everything, but it will be possible in this architecture, if we specified in the LCC protocol, for a single Odroid to be able to manage multiple data engines if the data engine is streaming data directly to whatever the destinations are. Now, I know I didn't really specify that in the document because I kind of made the assumption that like Tom said, that Odroid and that DE are kind of joined at the hip, and that Odroid controls him and only him, and he's responsible for it. So the Odroid is the face of that Tangerine SDR, that unit. But I think that there's an advantage to being able for a casual user to be able to just, here's an example. The guy goes, he buys a data engine, but he doesn't use the single board computer. He wants to use his desktop computer for that function. So he plugs the Odroid in. He plugs the DE into his desktop computer. So now the desktop computer is fulfilling the role of the single board computer, the local host, if you will. And the DE, of course, is the DE. So now, how do we do it? Because the data engine itself doesn't run a web server. It's the guy's desktop computer that now doesn't have the web server on it unless we give him the software to load that talks to the data engine directly. So how do you think we can solve that or address that configuration?
Well, if we want to make this thing affordable and implementable with the amount of time and effort we can afford to put into it, we can't necessarily support every conceivable way you could configure this thing. I mean, remember, also, we're in a phase one here. I mean, we don't necessarily need to get all the way to the land of Oz in this iteration of this thing, or do we?
Well, I'm just thinking in the case, what's going to happen in the production case is we're going to design the data engine and maybe one RF module and maybe not even the clock module to start with. So we're going to have a data engine with an RF acquisition module hooked to it. And that's going to be our first thing, okay? And we won't have a single board computer all programmed up and all ready to go. We're going to have the data engines. And so are we going to really reserve those just for developers, or are we going to ask other people to play too, or no?
Well, I guess I really hadn't considered releasing the data engine without having a single board computer paired up to it, ready to go about the same time. You really want to try and do that? Because that makes it, I don't know, now you've opened up the Pandora's box of, okay, now we got to support that. Everybody and their various different kind of computers, you know, they're going to write their own code to talk to the data engine and so forth. I was thinking that we would probably release the data engine and its matching little local host at the same time as a system. That's a Tangerine.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I think you're right. We'd just open up the Pandora's box and we'd have to support everybody's different desktop, different flavor of Linux, different this, different that, different the other thing. And, I mean, if an experimenter wants to take our code that we release with the Odroid, say, if we pick that board, and he wants to port that to his desktop, well, you know, let him have at it, but that's not really a configuration we're going to support, right?
I would agree, yes.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you both. We need to have a clear single deliverable that we can get out the door quickly and then, you know, and then release the source code along with it so that alternate implementations or different use cases, people will have access to the software and the documents and can do other things.
Yeah, my main concern is that I've heard some criticism that HPSDR, while it's way cool, is too difficult, it's too hard to figure out, it's too hard to configure. And so people looking for something simpler. And I think with the Space Weather Station, we're going to have to make it simple. It's that you're not going to, when we talk about using GitHub as being too hard, well, it better just be almost plug and play. Otherwise, we're going to have difficulty supporting it.
Well, Scotty, what I would recommend is the Space Weather Station, but at least building the hardware to be able to be a simple radio a la Red Pitaya kind of complexity.
But are you saying include the local host in that configuration or not?
I was originally assuming that, but it could be with or without. But I could see having two simple, one for the kind of enclosed box, ready to, or enclosed system, ready to go as a personal space weather station, and then one alternative of it that is simply a radio.
Okay, but the simply a radio, would what we're talking about is having that include an Odroid or whatever board, and then the single board, that's that single board computer becomes the face of the radio, and in that box that's the simple radio is a data engine and a single board computer still. Same hardware as a space weather station, but just configured differently. Or are you thinking data engine standalone is the radio? That is kind of like a la Hermes.
Yeah, I don't think I would go with the two together and not try to follow the Hermes route exactly.
Yeah, Dave, I would agree with that. The one of the issues that OpenHPSDR came up with is that, for example, the Hermes has to do a lot of the Ethernet and the IP functionality, and it's nice to be able to offload that to the Odroid since it will presumably have a Linux kernel. It's already got a lot of those features built in, making it a lot easier to implement the data engine.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But you know, if we were going to do that, we could allow the data engine to directly stream UDP to wherever it was told to by the local host, but we could almost use an I2C back channel from the local host to the data engine as the command port. And that way the Ethernet just becomes a pipe for data, and we have no discovery. We don't need any of that because it's connected with a wire.
Well, you just have to configure. I mean, you're going to plug the Odroid together to the data engine and just designate which pins the signal is going to travel on. Is that what you do, Scotty?
Yeah, well, the Odroid has a couple of pins designated as I2C ports, and the processor has an I2C controller on it, so it would just be a command channel, and it would appear as an I2C address to the Odroid processor, and then it could send and receive commands that way. I mean, I'm not sure we want to do that, because I really kind of like the idea of having just the Ethernet cable as the communications interface, but Tom has a good point. It may simplify the Ethernet interface inside the FPGA a whole lot to not have to do any of the command communication, just stream data.
Yeah, I was thinking more along the lines of if you have an Ethernet on the data engine and that Ethernet is going to stream somewhere other than the Odroid, it may have to have an IP address on it in order to stream. If you're going to stream with UDP, you've got to have an IP address. So if it has an IP address, it had to come from somewhere. It's got to have a subnet mask. You've got to worry about all those things.
Yeah, and you have to have a different IP address than the local host has.
Right. The other possibility is to assign all of those to the data engine in some kind of a configuration. Those are all the issues related to discovery. If you send packets somewhere else, you've got to have all those different addresses set up.
Right, right. And so, and of course, the discovery I'm talking about here is only the local command and control. So this never goes out. This is only for the segment that the data engine and the local host are on. However, you may have multiple local hosts with their own data engines on that same segment. So if you turn on discovery, local host number one will do a discovery, and he'll find data engine number one, which is his, and he'll also find all the other data engines on the board too. Or maybe I got this backwards. The data engine does the discovery, and all of the local hosts will respond, which is probably not what we want.
Yeah, there may be some options where the data engine can be provisioned with all of that information to get started and not have to not invoke it through a discovery process, but through some other process, like you were mentioning, Scotty. But I think you're still going to end up, if that Ethernet connects to not only the Odroid from the data engine, but is on the same network as anything else, I think all that information is going to have to get populated.
Well, so then it sounds like the LCC, the local command and control protocol, is still going to have provision for doing discovery, but maybe what you do is you have that turned off, or you have it enabled by a strap or something, so that you normally wouldn't do it, but it's defined, but it doesn't necessarily have to be implemented in the first go around here.
Yeah.
Scotty, you were talking earlier about an I2C communication between the local host and the data engine. Does that work like a serial port? I mean, I haven't really used I2C. You say it doesn't require addressing and all of that, but you can put multiple I2Cs on the same. I mean, there's got to be some kind of addressing, doesn't there?
Yeah, there's addressing in the nodes. So what you do is the I2C sends out a serial bit stream. It's a two-wire bit stream. So you send out the address, and then the guy whose address matches responds, and then you can establish communication between multiple devices. It's really meant for within-the-box components or chip-to-chip communication on a one board, that kind of thing for configuration. So I'm a little resistant to putting that out, because as soon as you require an I2C connection between two boards, now you've just limited the physical arrangements that you can have between the data engine and the local host. And I think I want to have the flexibility to put the local host on a different different physical place on the same subnet as the data engine.
Yeah, Scotty, could that be if there were non-volatile storage on the data engine, could you hook up that I2C, provision the data engine, and then save it, and then you could remove that cable and everything on the data engine would be already set to go?
Yeah, absolutely. And you could leave that non-volatile storage in an unprogrammed state, so that when it comes up and looks out at the non-volatile storage and says, oh, I'm unprogrammed, so somebody's going to have to program me. Or you can look and say, I mean, this is what Hermes does. If you want to program a fixed IP address into it, you can program that in and tell the board, use a fixed address. But if there's nothing programmed there, then it'll go out and do a query and a DHCP and ask for one. And by the way, we do have non-volatile storage on the data engine already in the spec.
Okay, I'm just wondering if that may simplify getting started here.
Yeah, and one of the things that I don't know if I've explained to anyone is that, because I haven't put it in the spec yet, but my business partner told me that I should put an MEC connector on the data engine alongside the M.2 connectors for the RF. So we'll have the two M.2s for two RF boards. It'll be identical and interchangeable. But we'll have this thing called an MEC connector. And the MEC connector is the same connector that our HF1 and HF2 RF boards use, and the TX2 also, which you're familiar with, the ones that SDR stick that we built, it's been 5 years now. The reason he said to do that is, first of all, the connector is gold fingers, so it's basically free. It's just some hard gold plating, so it's very inexpensive. And second of all, I've got boxes of these boards. So as soon as I get a data engine laid out and delivered, we got radios.
Well, assuming the firmware takes no time to implement.
Well, I meant the hardware. We have hardware radios, as opposed to having to wait for us to design an RF board and the added expense and all that. And basically, the front ends are like a Hermes front end and then a low-cost version. They're two different ones. 122.88 megahertz, 16-bit single channel, unfortunately, and then 14-bit 80 mega sample. Those are the two RF receiver boards that we have. And so the idea would be, is as soon as I get a data engine, I can start the hardware debug immediately, because I have boards.
And few crazy people like me have all those boards.
I would say that's forward thinking, not crazy.
Yeah, but that's a real advantage for somebody like me.
Yeah, just the subtle difference between genius and madness.
Yeah, I mean, ask anyone else. All of us are probably considered mad.
Would you like some more tea?
Yeah, Bill, I had a chance to do a few more experiments with HDF5 over this week.
Yeah.
And what I did is I set up Hermes to stream into my desktop computer. Hermes has a 100 megabit Ethernet because I'm using protocol 1, and that's what was implemented on it. And so I set it up to stream 4 384K channels. And that's on the Ethernet, that's about 82, 83 megabits per second. So it's up in the 82% utilization range. And then it's running into a Linux machine running GNU Radio. And from there, I put it into the MIT HDF5 coder. And I updated that from the old 1.8 that I had to the latest 2.6.1. And when I went to my SATA spinning Rust hard drive, it would not keep up. I would drop samples trying to go to that. So I implemented a RAM disk on the Linux machine, and I set that up for 12 gig. I've got 16 gig of RAM on the machine, so I set aside 12 gig of RAM, and I streamed it instead to the RAM disk, and it ran the 4x384K without dropping any samples at all.
Yeah, we have had a little bit of a discussion regarding as to whether we're going to tell people they have to have a solid-state disk for this to work as far as the full-blown implementation of the personal space weather station. And presumably the costs on those will come down. I haven't gotten far enough with the experiments I've been doing to be able to do a lot of experimentation with a spinning hard disk. I did a little bit, but I'm not sure that my results are valid yet. I'd have to play with it a little bit more.
Yeah, so then I ran some more experiments. In GNU Radio, it's pretty easy to duplicate a data stream. So I duplicated each of the 4384K complex floating point format signals. That doesn't change the Ethernet bandwidth because really there's just four streams, but in GNU Radio I duplicated it. So now I have eight 384K streams. And that's the same bandwidth that we spec'd originally on the personal space weather station of eight channels at 192 times two antennas. And so when I did that to RAM disk, I was dropping packets.
So what's the bandwidth of the RAM disk? You know what? How fast it is?
Oh, gosh, the bandwidth of the RAM disk is huge.
Well, what were the source of the dropped packets? I mean, the first thing I would be concerned of is whether GNU Radio itself is able to keep up. I mean, it would be better to run some of these tests using pure C code, but taking the samples and spitting them out without GNU Radio being in the process loop at all.
Yeah, I looked at that. I'm not dropping packets on the Ethernet interface between Hermes and the GNU Radio GR HPSDR module. So those, there's no Ethernet frames dropped there. The dropping is occurring in the GNU Radio floating point socket interface between GR HPSDR and the HDF5 module. And so I don't know where in there they're being dropped, but it's in there somewhere that it's happening. So I still have a little bit of concern about the kind of bandwidth. I agree with you. You know, what the GRHPSDR module is doing is it's receiving the Ethernet frames from Hermes. It's unpacking the four channels of 24-bit, 2's complement I and 2's complement Q, converting them to I floating point and Q floating point single precision, and then streaming those over to, through the output of the module over to the HDF5 module. And, you know, there's a lot of options there in that we could, in fact, stream the 2's complement from the data engine to the disk not do any conversion at all. Let the FPGA on the data engine do all the hard work so that we just stream 2's complement samples. The only time we would have to convert to HDF5 would be before we send the data to the central server.
Doesn't HDF5 support integer, with 2's complement numbers too?
It does. In my case, I already had them formatted in that mode. But what I'm thinking is we may want to dispense with what HDF5 has to do is create a file every second per stream. You can make that, you can say every 2 seconds or every 10 seconds or every X seconds, but the HDF5 coder generates a new file for every time slot for every stream. And so in my case, I had eight channels, and so I have eight streams, eight directories, and every second I generate eight new files. But, you know, we don't really need it in HDF5 format on the Odroid's disk storage. We only need that when we send the information to the central server.
Okay, but what information is in the HDF5 format that is not included in the in what the data engine sends over to the local host. It's all the metadata, right?
Yes, it's all the metadata. It's going to be time and date and a couple of other things that are in there. The reason I mentioned that is it may be very, a real simple C code to just shuffle Ethernet frames from the data engine and throw them onto hard drive and thereby minimize all possible computer processing between the engine and the storage device.
So then as the data is pulled off the hard drive to send to the central server, that would be the time that we would format it in the HDF5?
Well, that's one alternative. We could do all that coding since we'd only be doing it on a small subset of the data. And presumably, you have a limited bandwidth of maybe a megabit per second over the internet from your station up to the central server. It's not running very fast anyway. And so then the coding is running at a pretty slow rate, and it probably can keep up no problem.
Yeah, because it seems like we'd be doing ourselves a disservice if we said, oh, well, we have a limited upload bandwidth, so we're going to compress everything and crunch it down, all this, and then, oh, yeah, we're going to make it HDF5, which is going to add a whole bunch of overhead. So is that what? But then on the other hand, you have to have the information that's included in the HDF5 eventually at the central server. So what's the most efficient way to get it up there?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the thing is that with HDF5, from what I can figure out, seems to take care of a few things that we have to do on our own if we don't use HDF5. I mean, taking care of the metadata and timestamps and the ring buffer functionality. HDF5 handles a lot of that, so we shouldn't be too quick to dismiss it.
Okay, because otherwise we're going to have to implement those features ourselves.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, and so I think we have two alternatives, and it's way too early to tell which approach is the right one.
So just make the protocol and the hardware able to leave the flexibility for us to decide later.
Yeah, I'm just worried that we might end up with a situation that might not work. But if it turns out GNU Radio is what's slowing everything down, then maybe, as Bill suggests, an optimized C code to do it might solve the problem and eliminate it.
Well, certainly the formatting things that GNU Radio is doing, those can really be eliminated because the FPGA can format it any way you want. There's no reason why the FPGA can't give you floating point values if that's what you want.
Yeah, if that's the throughput limitation, doing the 2's complement to floating point conversion, then having the FPGA do it would be nice. If that's not the limiting factor, then we could still do it in the FPGA. One advantage of using 2's complement is it's 6 bytes per sample as opposed to 8 bytes per sample for the floating point. So you gain about a 33% advantage by shuffling 2's complement onto the disk and then converting it to floating point somewhere else.
Well, so what really does floating point, it doesn't buy us anything because it doesn't give us any more precision than the data that we started with. And if it takes 2 extra bytes per IQ sample, it seems like that's a bad choice.
Yeah, if you're going to do any digital signal processing, you're going to, I think, pretty sure, want to convert it to floating point before you do any significant amount of DSP.
That is true.
That's DSP on the single board computer or local processor or whatever.
Yeah.
Or anywhere.
Because fixed point DSP is unusually difficult.
That's what I do in the FPGA, so.
Well, Scotty, when you're talking about the data you're going to transfer from the data engine to the local host, how many bytes were you thinking per sample? 24? I mean, no. 3 bytes per I and 3 for Q or 4?
I'm thinking of 4 bytes, 2i and 2q, because we're really going to have only 14-bit data, and then we're going to decimate it down. And the decimation, so you theoretically might get 18 bits of data out of a 14-bit stream because of the amount of decimation we're going to do down to 192k. But the problem is that a 14-bit ADC doesn't have 14 effective number of bits. It might have 11 bits. So then you decimate down, you're still going to be under 16 bits. So I suspect that anything above 16 bits is kind of a waste of time with this kind of hardware. Although we ought to make sure the capability is there to do 24 or 32 bits, I don't think we need to do it out of the gate. I think 16 bits is going to be just a nice fit, and it makes things a whole lot easier if you can deal with just 2 bytes for I and 2 bytes for Q, I think.
I'm not sure I agree with that. The decimation process, of course, increases the dynamic range, or it decreases the noise floor so that you can you get more bits of precision. That converter may be 11 or 12 bits, but after decimation, I think it's going to be well above 16. I think it could be close to 20 bits.
Yeah, I agree. Let's say you got a 14-bit A to C analog to digital converter, but then you're going to decimate, and it's going to do a bunch of calculations with that, and all of a sudden you're practically filling 24 bits, and all of a sudden you're back up to, 6 bytes when you include I and Q both.
Well, for a decimation factor of 4, you gain 1 bit. So we could do the math from 122 megahertz down to 200 kilohertz, and I believe it's 640 to 48 kilohertz. So it would be 160 would be the decimation. I may have done that math wrong. And so that means you get 160 divided by 4. So I guess you do get some more bits. Sorry, it's not divided by 4. It's the power of 2. But that's still 7 bits, I think. It was 128. So you'd gain 7 bits in your decimation.
Yeah, so that puts us at, 21 bits of actual data. We're back to something very similar to METIS and OSI and the other systems that use 6 bytes, 3 each for I and Q.
Right, or we could just fix it at 4 bytes, but then, of course, you're limiting the data. It depends on how the single board computer and or the receptor of the UDP stream can deal with 6-byte streams versus 8-byte streams.
I don't think there should really be a major problem with the speed of data transfer between the data engine and the local host, because that can be designed to be very fast because it's all hardware, right? I mean, it's not going out across any noisy, lengthy internet connection. It's just right there.
Right, but it's still limited to the gigabit bit speed of the gig E. And keep in mind, too, that switch that I got on there shares the bandwidth with the external connection also. So whatever the throughput of the local host to the main server, it's shared with the data engine to the local host. And it all has to fit in 1 gig.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you look at the bandwidth requirements, I think it's if you were to use floating point, 4 bytes per 8 192 slots, 2 antennas, I think you come out somewhere around 200 megabits per second.
Well, so if we were to use floating point, and we're talking about 6 bytes per sample, floating point you said was 8, so that will be essentially equivalent to 8 bits. Sorry, 8 bytes per sample or 32 bits of data, but then 8 bytes of floating point doesn't give me 32-bit precision, does it?
Well, the I sample would be 4 bytes, which is a single precision floating point, and the Q would also be 4 bytes. Single precision floating point gives you 23 bits plus sine on the mantissa and 7 bits plus sine on the exponent.
Okay, so a 32-bit fixed point is actually more precision than a 23-bit mantissa on the floating point. But so you get more, I guess, I don't know how to describe it, more precision, but not as much dynamic range?
No, the two are equivalent. You get the same number of bits of range. When you go to floating point, if you have to do any numerical digital signal processing on it, that's where you don't have to worry about underflow and overflow and all that stuff. The floating point will take care of that for you. So in terms of the quality of the information, the two are equivalent, except the 2's complement takes 3 bytes and the floating point takes 4 bytes for I, and the same for Q.
Okay, so you're talking 8 bytes for floating point versus 6 bytes for fixed point.
Yes, exactly.
Well, again, I don't think this is critical because, you know, the FPGA can provide either one and, you know, whatever's needed.
Yeah, that and we can determine that later on after Bill's had a chance to look at, you know, throughput and where's the coding done and how are the samples used and things like that. So it's a decision we can defer to a later time.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to point out, too, that on the data engine right currently, I actually have a USB 3 super speed port, a device port. So if the host, if the local host also has a USB 3 port, if you want, you might be able to stream the data directly from the data engine through USB to the local host, and then you're not sharing the Ethernet connection to the outside world. And this would maybe help in cases where your Bill's use case two, where it's an institution-based, where they've got high-speed networks, and you can really fill up the whole gigabit Ethernet and actually be able to use it.
Bill, in your document, you mentioned something that I thought was intriguing about timestamping of the data. Could you discuss what you had in mind?
Well, I'm trying to think what you're referring to, but I think my understanding of the way digital RF works in conjunction with HDF5 is they include a timestamp in the metadata with each block of HDF5 data. And the ability to eliminate the timestamp from being commingled with the sample data, to me, is a big positive, because as we said earlier, then you don't have to worry about something happens to it if you compress it, and you don't have to count so many samples into a block of data to find the timing. It's handled separately. Is that what you're asking about, Tom?
Well, yeah, I was referring more to the LCC protocol between the data engine and the host. I think the FPGA is going to have to timestamp the sample, because if we're going to get down to plus or minus 50 nanoseconds of precision, we're going to need to identify the specific sample that's, you know, coincident with the second or some other way. You had something in there about using a Unix time or some other time to stamp the data between the data engine and the host?
Yeah, I mean, if you use Unix time, I guess the question is it precise enough? Are there enough significant bits of data there? I mean, we're talking about nanoseconds here. I can't bring it to mind how precise the Unix time is.
Yeah, there is a 64-bit packet type formatted by what's called NTP, Network Time Protocol. And its 64-bit stamp is set up so that the first 32 bits are Unix time in seconds, and the second 32 bits are fractional seconds. And so it can get you down to 1/4 of a nanosecond timestamp accuracy.
So is this something that the FPGA would probably have to calculate off the GPSDO outputs and kind of keep a... Because I was thinking the way we originally thought of it is, well, we'll mark time at the even seconds, and we'll mark the sample that falls on the even seconds. The alternative way I think that we're discussing now is that we take the first sample of the packet and we give it a seconds and fractional seconds time to that sample.
Yeah, I think both are alternatives. I had thought about the latter, where, you know, we identify the sample number that's coincident with the pulse per second edge coming from GPS. And Bill's idea, it to me was intriguing about, you know, at the beginning of the packet, put the seconds and fractional seconds. But, you know, I don't know which of the two is easier to do. So it's an interesting thing. One thing we probably ought to specify is I think we may need to timestamp the samples at the FPGA with GPS time, which is different than a coordinated universal time. And the reason for that, of course, is the data engine is only going to know precise time from the GPS module.
So how do we make it UTC eventually then? How do we correct it?
Well, the difference between them right now is 18 seconds. And that's because GPS time does not account for leap seconds, where UTC time does account for leap seconds. And rather than have the FPGA try to know how many leap seconds have occurred, you know, and that can change, you know, at the end of June, or it can change at the end of some month or some quarter. If we agree to transfer GPS time over to the host, then the host has enough computing horsepower, I think, to make that translation to UTC when it has to format it into HDF5.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think it does, but still it doesn't answer the question, should you have only the even second sample stamped, or should you stamp every packet with a fractional second? And my thought is that, well, you're going to have some value in the metadata on every packet. In the former case, it's going to be the offset into the packet of where the zero mark is, if there is a zero mark. The problem I see with this is if it's going to do it once per second, there's going to be a whole lot of packets that are going to have no zero stamp because they cover a hundredth of a second. So you're going to have 99 packets that have no mark or none, and then you're going to have one that says 384 samples in, that's the zero mark. The problem is if you're sending this via UDP, suppose that packet with the zero mark in it is the packet that gets lost. Now you got to go to 2-second intervals to go back to calculate the time, and it seems like it would be easier just to put the timestamp in every packet, the fractional seconds in every packet.
That reminds me of issues of how you do something like that with telemetry. I mean, there's a tendency to put a lot of timestamps in at easily recognizable locations. So maybe, as we were saying, the thing to do is to timestamp every packet or at some reasonable interval. Of course, if you're going to contend with UDP data occasionally getting lost, then you probably do need to put a timestamp on every packet.
Yeah, that would be good in identifying how many packets were lost.
Well, think of it this way.
I thought about that.
Well, there's 1,000 samples per packet, 1024, and it's about 8 nanoseconds per sample. So it's really about 8 microseconds difference between adjacent packets as far as what the approximate timestamps are going to be.
I think the number of samples, of course, once we down convert and decimate, the sample rate is going to be a lot slower, so the amount of time a packet occupies is going to be different than the clock rate of the ADC. But the key is, I don't know how difficult it would be to have the FPGA compute an NTP-style timestamp, basically a 64-bit number, and put that in each packet.
Yeah, and I think I have a further question here, too, is that, okay, so from the FPGA point of view, I'm going to get samples at 122 megahertz, and I'm going to multiply them by a NCO and an NCO shifted 90 degrees. So I'm going to get I and Q data from that. And then I'm going to take that data, so that's baseband data now, and then I'm going to apply filtering to that and give you a 200 kilohertz wide sample at whatever the NCO center frequency is, whatever you said, or one of the 8 NCOs. But now what is my timestamp? I mean, I got a timestamp on the actual acquisition, the clocking in of the raw data, but my filtering takes time, some number of clocks. Am I going to have to compensate for that?
Yes, actually. Although I think that can be done by, the filter function is a low-pass filter, so it'll be a 192 kilohertz low-pass filter. And, of course, that'll go from minus 192 to plus 192 since it's a low-pass with real taps. But we'll have to characterize the time delay through that low-pass filter so that we know how to compensate the timestamp.
Is it deterministic?
I think it will be deterministic.
Yeah, I'm not convinced so much of that because it's going to be a CIC filter, which is, then that will be deterministic. But then you're going to have a FIR filter after that, which I guess maybe that is deterministic.
Well, I don't know. You raise a good question. Is the time delay the same everywhere? And I would think, thinking about it, maybe not, because there's going to be group delay variation. If you have just FIR filters, which have linear delay, then it's deterministic, and it's linear delay. I don't know what the CIC filter does to it. That's a good question.
Brett, I wanted to break in here a minute. I think I need to go for check in with my family, so I'm going to say 73 and talk to you next week.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave, for hanging in there and running this. It's going to be awesome here. It's going to be a fun project. And 73.
I agree as well.
Yeah, we'll see you later, Dave. 73.
Catch you later, maybe.
Well, I think Dave may have had the right thing. It's we've been on here, what, an hour and a half. Maybe it's time to wrap up for tonight.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. We'll end up with marathon sessions, but it seems like we accomplish an awful lot being able to talk rather than just do emails.
Yep.
Yeah, we resolved a couple of things, and so that's pretty good.
At least we're not trying to do this on 20 meters. Oh, by the way, 6 meters is open, in case anybody wants to go play on that.
Oh, where is it open to?
Nationwide. I haven't looked at it in the past few minutes. I had to shut down Smart SDR so that I could get the driver working for this, so I haven't looked at it in the past hour, but... it was open all over North America when we started our session.
All right. So it's like feel like you're blind, deaf, and dumb, right, with the radio shut off?
That's right. There's nothing going on.
Okay, well, I guess we'll be back to email, and thanks for everyone for showing up, and thanks to Mike for doing the recording. And in the next couple of days, Mike, I'll have a place for you to put the recordings. I'm not sure how big they are, so they probably are too big for you to email, especially this marathon one. But I'm going to try to get you an FTP site that you can upload it to.
73 to everybody. I'm going to pack it in. Take care.
Yeah, good night, all. We'll catch you the next time, maybe for EJ Clear.
Okay, 73's everyone, and Bill and Dave and Tom.
All right, thanks, Scotty. We'll see you next week. Take care.